Thanks for listening to On the Porch. I'm your host, Silas House. We have a great novelist on the line with us today. Wally Cash is the New York Times best-selling author of the novels A Land More Kind Than Home and This Dark Road to Mercy, as well as his latest, The Last Ballad, which just came out in paperback. Wiley is a native of North Carolina. He currently serves as the writer-in-residence at the University of North Carolina at Asheville, and he teaches in the Mountain View Low Residency MFA. He lives with his wife and two young daughters in Wilmington, North Carolina. The New York Times Book Review says this about The Last Ballad, a powerful book in which Cash has pulled from the wreckage of the past a lost moment of Southern progressivism. Thanks for being here, Wally. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Silas. It's a treat to be with you.
Well, describing one's novel is always the hardest question, so we might as well start with that. So tell our listeners what you want them to know about The Last Ballad.
That is a hard question, and that's something I really struggled with. You know, I'm sure a lot of people who listen to the show are writers, and trying to figure out what your book is about as opposed to what happens in your book, those are very different things. So
it is.
What my book is about a 29-year-old single mother who swept up in a violent textile mill strike in the summer of 1929 in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina.
Beyond that, if you had to boil it down to the main theme, what would that be for you with this book?
I think what the theme of the book, it's about the convergence of race and class and gender and politics and economics, and during the summer of 1929, right before the Great Depression kind of came and leveled the playing field of sorts in some ways, especially in the South and these textile communities. So the book is about all these great upheavals of class and gender and race.
And so, of course, that's really timely. I mean, it seems like our national conversation becomes more and more and more about those things, don't you find?
Yeah, it's funny. I was finishing the book in the summer of 2016 and kind of going through the last edits during the election, and I thought, oh my God, I wrote a book about the 2016 election and not about the politics of 1929, you know, because the book is about a woman named Ella Mae Wiggins. She was a real person, and the book's about a real strike that happened in Gastonia, my hometown, in 1929, and this was this tough woman standing up to the forces of greed and asking for a fair shot and a living wage and bringing in all different kinds of people of you know, different races and different classes to rally for the cause. And it was very reminiscent of what's been going on recently.
Yeah, now it's teachers.
Yes, absolutely. Teachers in West Virginia, teachers in North Carolina, teachers in Oklahoma, people asking for, you know, not for something extra. They're asking for what they're due. They're asking for a living wage. They're asking for their ends to meet. They're asking for their pay to match their work.
Right. That's definitely been happening here in Kentucky. Our educators have really been having a time of it lately. And it's just interesting how, you know, those struggles continue. Do you think that as a novelist, you have a theme that unites all three of your novels? What is it?
Gosh, I don't know. I think there probably is a theme if I had to reach for one. You know, all my books, I'm similar to you, Silas. I write about the places that I'm from, places I call home, places that I'm familiar with. And I had someone ask me yesterday if there's any romantic notion in that or any, like, homecoming implication. And I said, no. I said, it's just a matter of convenience, to be honest. I mean, I love the place that I'm from. But it's also a matter of convenience that I have these ideas and I want to put them in a place, and this is the place that I know the best. And so it's just kind of natural that I'm writing about these places. So all of my novels are linked geographically, but I think all of my books, to a certain degree, are about being rather than seeming. The motto of the state of North Carolina is to be rather than to seem. But I was raised, you know, like you, Silas. I mean, I know you well enough, and I know your work well enough, and your cultural experience well enough to know that you were raised in an evangelical household just like I was, and, you know, I was raised under the sway of the 80s televangelist and you know, sold a bill of goods that wasn't always true, and that happens, you know, all over the country, but it's especially happened to be the plight of the Southern evangelical in the 1980s and that's the kind of society I was raised in, to really never question anything, to always believe what you heard the elders say or heard the televangelists say. And even when they did something wrong, it was the devil's fault. But when you did something right, it was, you know, the grace of God that led you to do it right. And so human accountability was taken out of everything. You were never worthy of anything good, and you could never really be blamed for anything bad. And I think that theme of being rather than seeming has found its way into all my books.
Mm-hmm. And don't you think that when you have an artist's sensibility, one of your real driving forces is asking questions? And so to be told that you shouldn't be asking them just makes you want to know the answers even more.
It does. And it makes you, as a child especially, it makes you suspicious of the people around you.
Yes.
And it makes you hesitant to share yourself with them, like from an artistic sentiment or from a cultural standpoint. You just think, you know, when am I going to get to let people know that I think this? Or this sounds so uppity, but when am I going to get these to let these people know they're wrong? That was kind of something I felt I was sitting on for quite a while. Or when is this crazy behavior going to be called crazy behavior instead of just the world, you know?
Did you sort of declare an artistic sensibility early on as a child, or did that come later for you?
I think I did early. I was really into reading and basketball. Like when I was a kid, the main things you did in my hometown were you played outside in the woods, you shot basketball in the driveway, or you read, right? That's kind of what you did in my family. My brother and sister and I all kind of did those three things. And I always liked reading because when I couldn't shoot basketball because of the rain or snow or couldn't go outside, I could always read. And because I could always read, I was never bored. Like we didn't play video games. I kind of was right on the cusp of video game playing. I didn't ever fall into it. But in my family, you know, reading was encouraged, and we were never bored because we could always read. And I grew up reading. I grew up around storytellers. And so it just felt natural to try to tell stories. And so I think any artistic impulse I had early on was telling stories and seeing what I could get away with. You know, what kind of lies can I tell that are clearly lies but seem true? And so I really pushed the bounds of acceptability in terms of truth-telling and storytelling and lying and blending fact and fiction and recreating scenes and adding fictive elements. So if I have any artistic impulse at all, it came from those experiences.
Mm-hmm. I had such a similar childhood, you know, basketball. I wanted so badly to be a really great basketball player because so many people in my family, women and girls and boys in my family, were just so good. And, you know, I was okay, but I knew that was something I would never be a star at. And I think that pushed me more to the books, but I loved both of those things. And also just being around storytellers. And based on your writing, what I see in your writing, I would predict that you were around older people, and that you know, that's something that I really grieve, is I don't see younger people mixing among generations as much anymore. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, I've never thought about it that clearly. But yeah, I would say that's definitely true. You know, we visited my grandparents, my mom's parents came from mills, textile mills, and my dad's family, they were kind of on the tail end of mill life. They had grown up on farms. And so they'd lived these very rural lives. And I can remember we'd visit one set of grandparents every week, and we'd sit on the swing and tell stories, or I would hear them tell stories. My dad's family more than my mom's family, but they all told stories. And I think, you know, the church setting, being around older people, like in youth group, chaperones, things like that, summer camp, being around older camp counselors telling stories, and all of my friends, I'm still good friends with all the guys that I kind of grew up with in Gastonia, but all of them are storytellers. And so we tell each other stories, we began to tell stories about things we didn't witness as if we did witness them, and all these things kind of blend together. But I was similar with basketball. Like I played in high school, and I knew I wasn't going to play in college, but I thought, God, I love this. And I was always impressed by athletes who had given themselves over to being great at something.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, what if I try to give myself over to writing? And I just, I work at it like I'm shooting free throws or like I'm shooting
exactly
shots or something. How can you cultivate that kind of inclination?
This is On the Porch. I'm your host, Silas House, and we are talking to New York Times bestselling author Wiley Cash here on 91.3 WUKY, listener-supported radio. Well, the last ballad is set in 1929. A Land More Kind Than Home was set in the 80s, and then This Dark Road to Mercy was set in 1998. So those last two are a little more contemporary. Well, they're definitely more contemporary, but they're still now the past. They're now distinct historical periods. But we would think of 1929 as being much more that. Do you love writing about a specific historical period, or is it a challenge, or talk about that?
I don't know. I kind of feel like I didn't, you know, I'm not saying these stories like found me in a cosmic sense, but I didn't really seek these stories out. So I didn't think, you know, I really want to write something set in the 80s with flashbacks to the teens and 60s. And I just kind of stumbled on these stories and figured when they would fit. You know, the strike in 1929 is very much of that moment. And the home run, the book in 1998 is set against the home run race with Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. And so that just wanted to write about that, kind of, I kind of had to lock it into 98. But people have asked me about historical fiction, and I think all writing is historical to a certain degree, because you're always accountable to an era, to a cultural moment, to a historical moment, to a national mindset, perhaps. You know, for example, the my second novel, This Dark Road to Mercy, set in 1998 with the home run race between McGwire and Sosa. And I really believe that that was the last time this country was all united around something positive. I think the 2008 election with Obama was a feel-good moment for the country, but not everybody voted for Obama. But I think in 1998, everybody, whether you were a baseball fan or not, had an eye on the home run race, and we were cheering for these two American heroes. But there's also great irony in that, going back to the seeming and not being, and that these guys were pumped up on steroids, and the whole thing was kind of a lie, and it was kind of a sham. But for that one summer, we were all united. And so you know, going back to writing about 1998, I had to think about, you know, what did people dress like? What did people's hair look like? What kind of music was on the radio? And what did it feel like to be positive about the American moment in that summer?
Well, you have written about race, and so I'm wondering if you grew up in a really integrated community, or what was your experience like growing up in Gastonia in that respect?
It was pretty integrated. My neighborhood was definitely majority white. The neighborhood I live in Wilmington now is much more integrated than when I lived in Gastonia. The school was, you know, relatively integrated, but it was primarily white. But I played basketball at the YMCA, and that was probably relatively fully integrated. My church was primarily 99% white Baptist evangelical. But I've always felt comfortable writing about race. I think a lot of it is because, you know, I have a PhD in American Lit from University of Louisiana, and I chose University of Louisiana to pursue my degree because Ernest Gaines was the writer in residence there, and I got to study under him. And he was the first writer that I felt like I saw my own story in, which is ironic because, you know, he's born in 1933 in the Jim Crow South. His ancestors were slaves and sharecroppers. He was born in a sharecropper's cabin, couldn't go to school in Louisiana because they were, you know, didn't have school for black kids in middle school, and had to go out to California to complete his schooling. But the way he wrote about land, the way he wrote about landscape, the way he wrote about old people, that was how my parents and my grandparents talked about land and landscape and old people. And I hadn't read Ron Rash. I hadn't read Lee Smith yet. I hadn't, Cold Mountain hadn't really come out yet. I don't believe it had come out yet. And I didn't know that people who were near me geographically were writing about these things, because I wasn't taught Lee Smith and Ron Rash and Charles Frazier in undergraduate, or certainly not in high school. And I kind of stumbled across Ernest Gaines. And so I saw so much kinship in the way he wrote about those things. And I also, part of my graduate study was about an African-American writer in North Carolina named Charles Chestnut, who lived from 1858 to 1932. And the way he wrote about the racial dynamics in North Carolina and the South around Reconstruction and World War One just interested me so much. And I saw so much tension, and I think tension's where story comes from. And there's so much tension surrounding race relations. It's kind of the obvious thing to write about in the South, but it's much more nuanced than it's often presented. And I think Ernest Gaines and Charles Chestnut were just masters at the nuances of race and all of the issues and problems and challenges surrounding it. And so I felt, after studying under them and studying about them and so many other African-American writers, I felt not qualified to write about race, but I felt comfortable writing about race. I thought I could either write about what I know or what I was willing to figure out.
Well, I've heard you talk about Ernest J. Gaines before. How amazing to be able to work with him. I mean, one of the real masters of American literature. And I know that Gail Godwin is somebody that you've often cited as being really generous to you.
Before I got an agent, I reached out to a couple of writers who'd influenced me and asked them to look at my book, A Land More Kind Than Home. And there was a time, I don't think she does anymore, where Gail had her P.O. box on her website. And I wrote her a note and said, you know, you don't know me. I know all your books. I'm from North Carolina. I wrote this book set in North Carolina. Would you look at it? You know, tell me to go jump, you know, whatever. So she wrote me an email and said, yeah, I'll check it out. So I sent it to her, and I asked the same of Clyde Edgerton, Bobby Ann Mason, who I'd met very briefly, and Gaines did it because he had read some of it anyway. And so when I went out for agents, I kind of had these standard bearers of Southern Lit behind me saying the book was worth something.
Right.
I have no doubt that their opinions validated my manuscript more than my, you know, query letter ever could have.
Yes.
But Gail Godwin has just kind of been, you know, I've only met her a couple of times, but she's kind of been this fairy godmother of American lit to me. She was really encouraging with my first book, continued to keep in touch with me. I was kind of intimidated to respond to her, you know, uninvited, but she would send me notes from time to time. She read something that I had said about this, the last ballad, and that I was working on it, and she wrote me this email that said, you know, take your time, hold on to this book as long as you can. You know, don't let it go too soon. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a big project, and, you know, you've done everything right in your career so far. Just hold on to this book. And I was at a point with the book that I needed somebody like her to give me permission to hang on to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it made such a huge difference. And then several years ago, she emailed me out of the blue, and she said I was going to be at the South Carolina Book Festival, which is now no longer, unfortunately. But she had this dinner where she invited me and Ron Rash and Lee Smith and everybody's spouses. And we had this amazing dinner for hours one night and just told stories. And I was just sitting there with my wife, and we were just sitting there asking ourselves, like, how are we here? This is crazy.
Yeah. Lee Smith has been that fairy godmother for me. She's so generous.
Well, my wife, Mallory, is working on this project that you and Jason are involved in as well, about modern Appalachia self-portrait. She was with Lee a couple of nights ago down in Hillsborough. Mm-hmm. She was going on and on about your book and how much she's looking forward to having you in town.
Well, you've written three novels in a decade. You have children. You teach. How do you get all that done?
I don't know. I really don't, because I don't feel like I use my time that well. I'm always doing something. But I have an incredible support in my wife. I mean, she's just an incredible support. She gives me so much freedom to try things, to make mistakes. She always gives me permission to, you know, go to a residency or go on a long book tour or head up to the office and Skype with the book club when the girls need to be put to bed. And I have this illusion that we co-parent, but I know we don't. You know, I'm home a lot. But a lot of that time is not spent parenting. It's spent answering email and trying to squeeze out a few words before I go teach or before I go on book tour or before I, you know, I'm sitting in a hotel right now. I'm always traveling around, and she kind of keeps things going. And she's a professional. She's a photographer, and she's got her things she's trying to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to reach a point in my career where I can slow down enough and have and all these plates I've got spinning, have them spin without me having the forward momentum. Just set them all spinning into the, you know, into the ether so that, you know, I can let her have these vast swaths of time like she allows me to have. But everything that I do, it's because she either encourages it or okays it.
Well, Wiley, I know you're a big music lover and music shows up in your work. So who are some of your favorite musicians?
You know, I listen to a lot of music. Unfortunately, I listen to a lot of it passively. So I listen to a lot of streaming music. I listen to a lot of old CDs over and over. But, you know, people that I always come back to, there are several musicians that are touchstones for me. One is a guy in Western North Carolina. He's from Weaverville, named Malcolm Holcomb. He's kind of a Tom Waits kind of singer-songwriter, Americana singer-songwriter. He is just he's one of the artists whenever I leave North Carolina to leave somewhere else, I take him with me. Another is Shannon Whitworth. She was in a band called the Biscuit Burners several years ago, mm-hmm. but now she's solo. She's just a brilliant singer-songwriter. People who are more popularly known, Brandi Carlile, who I think is a genius.
Me too.
Jason Isbell and Nico Case are three, you know, kind of international stars. The past several years, I've just been marveling at everything they do and their social positions and how vital their music and their voices seem and how many currents they cross with their music and how many audiences they appeal to. I think those are some of the most brilliant people writing today, not just doing music, but writing period today.
What about books? Which ones have been really instrumental for you?
Well, I just got a copy of a new book called Southernmost. I look forward to cracking that one open. I picked that up today at Park Road Books in Charlotte. And I also picked up Zora Hurston's book, Barracoon. Mm. I haven't read that yet, but I read Alice Walker's introduction while having lunch today, and I'm just openly weeping in this restaurant. But I read a lot of nonfiction, and I read a lot of stuff by friends. My friend Craig Childs just had a book come out called Atlas of a Lost World about him going to places where Ice Age humans made settlements and trying to figure out why they were there and why they chose these spots. And that's pretty fascinating. But I was talking to you about Lisa Coe's The Leavers.
Yes.
Last time I saw you, that book is just breathtaking. It's just so beautifully written and so, so important right now.
Well, I've asked you to bring along a short section of the last ballad to read for us. So I'll give you a moment to get that ready. While I tell our listeners, they are listening to On the Porch here on WUKY 91.3 FM. I'm your host, Silas House, and we're talking to Wiley Cash. Are you ready?
I am. I thought I'd read just the opening couple of pages of The Last Ballad, which is out in paperback June 5th. Ella Mae knew she wasn't pretty, had always known it. She didn't have to come all the way down the mountain from Tennessee to Bessemer City, North Carolina to find that out. But here she was now, and here she'd been just long enough for no other place in her memory to feel like home, but not quite long enough for Bessemer City to feel like home either. She sat on the narrow bench in the office of American Mill No. 2, the wall behind her vibrating with the whir of the carding machines, rollers, and spinners that raged on the other side, with lint hung up in her throat and lungs like tar, reminding herself that she'd already given up hope of ever feeling rooted again, of ever finding a place that belonged to her and she to it. Instead of thinking thoughts like those, Ella turned and looked at Goldberg's brother's young secretary, where she sat behind a tiny desk just a few feet away. The soft late-day light that had already turned toward dusk now picked its way through the windows behind the girl. The light lay upon the girl's dark, shiny hair and caused it to glow like some angel had just lifted a hand away from the crown of her head. The girl was pale and soft, her cheeks brushed with rouge and her lips glossed a healthy pink. She wore a fine powder blue dress with a spray of artificial white spring flowers pinned to the lapel. She read a new copy of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and she laughed to herself and wet her finger on her tongue and turned page after page while Ella watched. How old could that girl be? Ella wondered. 20? 25? Ella was only 28 herself, but she felt at least 2-3 times that age. She stared at the girl's dainty, manicured hands as they turned the pages, and then she looked down at her own hands where they rested upturned in her lap, her fingers intertwined as if they'd formed a nest. She unlocked her fingers and placed her palms flat against her belly, thought about the new life that had just begun to stir inside her, how its stirring often felt like the flutter of a bird's wing.
Great. Thanks so much for being here with us, Wiley.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Silas.
I hope everybody out there will go get a copy of The Last Ballad, now out in paperback. It's a lovely and important novel.